legalization of cannabis for recreational use in 2019, the market for cannabis products exploded, as well as the claims for what cannabis and its constituent molecules could be used for. Cannabis has been used medicinally by many different groups for hundreds of years. However, the substance was made illegal in Canada in 1923. The criminalization of cannabis was heavily influenced by racial biases against Chinese Canadians, with the demand for stricter drug laws strongly influenced by propaganda and fear around another drug, opium, being brought in the country by immigrants. In the United States, the demonization of marijuana, which was the term used by Mexicans, was a racist tactic used to limit Mexican immigration by conflating Mexicans as wild, immoral drug users. In 1936, the now famous film Reefer Madness fueled hysteria about the drug. It pushed the narrative that marijuana caused your children to become hardened criminals and descend into madness. However, with the turn of the century, public perception has gradually become more accepting of cannabis. In 2001, the medical use of cannabis was legalized in Canada, and then in 2019, it was made legal to use recreationally for anyone over the age of majority. To learn more about the medical use of cannabis and or CBD, we talked to Dr. Ruth Ross.
I am Professor of Pharmacology at the University of Toronto, and I'm Chair of the Department of Pharmacology and Toxicology in the Faculty of Medicine. Yeah, and my research topic is the pharmacology of cannabinoids and cannabis.
From Facebook and Reddit articles to Time magazine special issues, the media portrays cannabis as the new miracle drug that can cure everything from pain, anxiety, epilepsy, ADHD, inflammatory bowel disease, insomnia, and more. With the transition from taboo topic into a mainstream phenomenon, it's hard to keep up with all the new claims being made about wacky tobacky. But before we dive into specific ailments this miracle drug is touted to cure, it's helpful to have an understanding of what exactly cannabis is and what the differences are between the two most well-known components of cannabis, CBD and THC. First, we need to understand that cannabis mimics a compound we all have in our body, and most importantly, in our brain. In fact, cannabis interacts with something called the endocannabinoid system, which is a group of signaling molecules with widespread effects throughout the brain and body. So even if you haven't ever tried cannabis before in your life, we all have an active endocannabinoid system, and it's extremely important in your body to keep it running smoothly.
Yeah, well, the endocannabinoid system is kind of lipid signaling system in the body, and it's involved in a whole lot of different physiologies. We call it the endocannabinoid system, and like lots of other systems, it consists of a number of components, and the components are the actual signaling molecules, so those are the endocannabinoids. And those are eicosanoid molecules, and they're called anandamide and 2-arachidonyl glycerol, or 2-AG. And the other parts of the system are the receptors with which those endocannabinoids interact. So those are cannabinoid CB1 and CB2 receptors. And then there are also enzymes that are responsible for synthesizing the endocannabinoids and enzymes responsible for degrading the compounds, so inactivating them. So that's the endocannabinoid system. And then as it happens, THC interacts with the endocannabinoid system. So THC is one of the major components of cannabis, and it is actually a CB1 receptor activator. So the endocannabinoid system is involved in, we know it's involved in things, for example, like stress and anxiety. It's involved in memory and learning. It's involved in pain processing. It's involved in appetite. Seems to be involved in sleep as well.
I'm sure you've noticed that this list is similar to some of the effects of cannabis in the body. Because cannabis interacts with the endocannabinoid system, it's not a stretch to wonder if it could be used medically to alleviate anxiety and pain or help us sleep. However, the endocannabinoid system is intricate and complicated, and researchers are still trying to understand the basics of the system, let alone how cannabis alters it.
So it's really involved in a lot of different things that affect our behavior and our physiology. And then it can also be potentially dysregulated under different circumstances as well in different diseases. It may be potentially be upregulated or downregulated. And those are the kinds of things we're really still in the reasonably early stages of research to understand what the dysregulations might be under different circumstances. We do know that when, for example, in obesity and metabolic syndrome, CB1 receptor antagonists were developed way back in, you know, many years ago in the 90s for treating obesity and metabolic syndrome. And they actually were working to some extent, and some patients found benefits from them, particularly in combination with exercise, for example. And so what the hypothesis or the premise there was that the endocannabinoid system is kind of overactive, and it's responsible for increased appetite and different effects on the liver, for example, that caused metabolic syndrome and type 2 diabetes or liver issues. And so it kind of, that hypothesis was potentially correct and proved to work. But the issue was then, if all the CB1 receptors were globally blocked across the brain, then there was this kind of adverse event happening where there was a certain incidence of increased suicidal ideations and some suicides and anxiety. So on one hand, downregulating the system had a beneficial effect, but on the other hand, because it's so globally expressed and it's so globally important in lots of things, that turned out to be a problem. So in some ways, the nature of the endocannabinoid system being involved in so many things is both kind of blessing and a curse in a way. It's great because it does a whole bunch of things, but then it becomes difficult to just target one part of the system in an illness, which is what you're always looking for with a therapeutic, to be selective and targeted.
The endocannabinoid system is complex, so globally targeting the system can have detrimental effects. Researchers are trying to understand how specific molecules affect the endocannabinoid system and identify certain targets that could be manipulated by future medications. One promising area of research is looking at altering the enzymes that degrade endocannabinoids. This could lead to the development of medications that increase endocannabinoids in a safer, more physiological way rather than bombarding the system with synthetic compounds. Many people know that THC is the part of cannabis that will get you high, whereas CBD, the other common compound in cannabis, is thought of as a harmless molecule that can be used to treat many illnesses. We dove deeper with Dr. Ross into the differences between these two important components of cannabis.
So, for example, some synthetic cannabinoids that people have made that are originally they were made for scientific purposes, but they have been made also, and people have taken them kind of illegally and had some nasty effects. But these are what we call full agonists, and THC is a partial agonist, which means it doesn't produce the maximum effect on CB1. And so it activates the CB1 receptor, and that produces a number of effects that can be similar to the endocannabinoid system. So, for example, THC causes appetite stimulation, and that's equivalent to kind of like an activation of the CB1 receptor in the endocannabinoid system. But if anyone is a pharmacology geek, they'll know that partial agonists can also behave as antagonists. So if the levels of endocannabinoids are really high for some reason, then THC can actually, because it's less of an activator, can actually offset some of those effects and actually downregulate some of those effects of an endocannabinoid agonist. And also THC, so high doses, frequent use, will actually switch off the CB1 receptor, desensitize it, downregulate it. So in all, CB1's a G protein coupled receptor, and all G protein coupled receptors are subject to this effect where they're designed to not be overactivated or activated for too long, so they become downregulated, and so the effect is then switched off. So a similar thing to, for example, opioids, that similar scenario that happens. So that's THC. And so THC, the effects are complex because it can either mimic the endocannabinoids, or it can actually block the effects potentially of the endocannabinoids. And it may have different effects, like we said, in different illnesses, because if the endocannabinoid basal levels are high, it might have a certain effect. If they're low, it might have a different effect. So it's different in different people, different illnesses, different doses, frequency of use. So when people say cannabis does ABC, there's a lot of additional information and questions we need to ask around those statements. So that's THC. CBD is really different. It's the small structural change means it's not a CB1 receptor agonist, direct agonist. There is some evidence it might modulate CB1, but that's still in the realms of really being in more in cellular models. We've seen that rather than anything in an animal model or human. So there's also some evidence that it might affect certain parts of the endocannabinoid system, like the enzymes. Again, it's in the realm of being preclinical cellular model data, so we don't know for sure about that. CBD also acts on a number of molecular targets that aren't part of the endocannabinoid system, and a whole plethora of receptors and so on, but all at reasonably high doses, high concentrations. So the reality is we're still really trying to understand how CBD works. Is it effective? What does it do? And what are its molecular targets? So that's very much the topic of research currently.
As Dr. Ross said, we don't really know all the specific molecular targets of CBD. And CBD also acts on a number of targets that aren't part of the endocannabinoid system. It might be shocking to hear that the scientific community is still trying to understand how CBD acts in the body. This information contradicts the widespread narrative that CBD cancels out the effects of THC by binding to CB1 receptors, making the high less intense. We have also seen advertisements for CBD products that claim to act only on the CB2 receptor, which is not proven at all. Needless to say, it is somewhat worrying, considering the widespread usage of CBD, that we still don't know what it's really doing in the body. Hopefully, with the increase of research into CBD, we will get an answer to these questions soon. We also won't understand the long-term effects of CBD for a while, because, historically, cannabis has always contained relatively low levels of CBD, and the current usage for medical effects is in much higher doses. Therefore, even though cannabis has been used therapeutically for ages, we won't know the effects of high-dose CBD in the population for a long time, since it is relatively new. However, since cannabis containing THC and lower levels of CBD have been around longer, we know the specific adverse effects on the body from THC, specifically in certain populations.
So things to be aware of would be this idea that for certain people it would be contraindicated. So for people potentially with any, who'd had any kind of first episode psychosis or a family history of psychosis, something like that, it's a red flag. People are concerned about under 25s because there is this issue around potential effects on brain development that are still undergoing changes during that period of young adulthood. And we're still trying to understand whether there might be implications of using THC, for example, during that period. So that would be a group that would be potentially at risk. The other concern is cannabis use disorder, which it affects a small, it's not a massively widespread problem, but it is a potential issue. And if people are using higher doses more frequently, there is a potential of developing a dependence. And that's then something that would need to be managed carefully with a physician, which is why it's important with medical use that people are using this with someone who's managing the prescription and their medical use with them in partnership, rather than potentially self-medicating, which people could run into problems. It's been known for a long time that there's a high instance of use of cannabis in certain groups of people. And then it's also been known for some time that THC use can cause an acute psychosis. So people can get, this would happen in a lot of people who use high dose THC. Maybe, for example, people, it's happening now where people are taking edibles and nothing happens. So they take a bit more because there's a delayed reaction with edibles, and then they end up taking a high dose. So people can become, they can become fearful or kind of lose touch with reality or develop kind of paranoia or anxiety. And so that's an effect that THC can have acutely. But there's also a lot of evidence and growing evidence that people can have, potentially people who are at risk of developing schizophrenia, if they use THC, particularly say in adolescence or at high dose, it can actually cause an earlier onset of the illness and maybe a more severe form of the illness. So we do not fully understand why that is. We do know there are big changes in the endocannabinoid system in people with schizophrenia. So it's dysregulated in some way. And so potentially then you layer THC on top of that, and it interacts with this system that is dysregulated in psychosis. What happens is it actually makes the symptoms worse and makes things more, harder to manage. Mm-hmm. So that's something that certainly is fairly well established, and would definitely be something that people should be aware of for both non-medical use and for medical use. Both in both realms, people should be aware that that's a concern.
Also, deciding the best route of administration of cannabis is important to consider prior to using it for medicinal purposes. The route of administration of any drug changes what effects it will have on the body and how quickly it will exert its effects, which have both practical and medicinal implications. While there is still plenty to discover about how cannabis works, there's just as much to consider in terms of how it can best be used in the real world.
So how quickly something gets into the brain, how quickly the effects disappear. So for example, people get high quickly with inhaled and then the effects disappear reasonably quickly, whereas edibles, there's a long onset time and they stay in the system for a long time. So it's a slower onset time. And there are, of course, all sorts of considerations there with what you're using it for and what works best for the different medical condition. There are problems around inhaled, of course, because we don't want to recommend that people smoke. And then vaping, we're still got a bit of a question mark there with vaping that kind of emerged from nowhere. So there's that issue, but it would potentially have been a lot preferable had we not discovered, some of these potential issues with vaping, although we don't know what underlies that. And then edibles, potentially, avoiding any of those issues with inhale. But then there's problems with potentially still testing positive for THC long after the event. So if people are medicating with medical cannabis, say at night, they may still fail a driving impairment test many, many hours later in the morning. So they may not be impaired, but they may be above the legal blood limits for THC. So because there's a kind of disconnect between impairment and levels of THC, which is another complication because it's very person specific and depends if you're kind of tolerant to the THC because you're using it either medically or non-medically. Whereas if you're a naive user, you could be highly impaired with quite a low amount. So that's not straightforward either.
According to the American Family Physician Journal, cannabis can be detected in urine drug tests 2 days following a single dose, and up to 4 to 6 weeks after cessation of heavy daily cannabis usage. This is important to consider with a potential therapeutic because it could have implications on a patient's ability to drive. While these drug tests do not screen for CVD, a study conducted in Germany found that 25% of all CBD products they tested contained THC above the lowest observed adverse effect level, 2.5 milligrams per day. CBD is supposed to be regulated in the same way THC products are within Canada, where a business requires a license under the Cannabis Act to sell any CBD products. However, many unregulated CBD products are still being sold outside of licensed cannabis systems, mostly due to confusion around the legality of doing so. So even though drug tests aren't looking for CBD, the risk that some products may have small amounts of THC creates the possibility that the THC could build up in your body and result in a positive test. Tune in next week for part two, which will focus on the health claims made in regards to cannabis and CBD, and what scientific evidence exists to support these claims. Thanks for listening to this episode of Hashtag Health. If you enjoyed listening to our podcast, please consider giving us a rating or review and subscribing to our show. You can also follow us on Instagram or Twitter at Hashtag Health Podcast, or like us on Facebook. This episode was created by Mary Nguyen and me, your host, Sarah Howard.